Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. We're going to have an hour of medical discussion, dialogue, a little bit of healthcare in the news, some interesting scientific and social controversies, all in the next hour, along with answers to your emails and phone calls. So I hope you'll stay tuned and join us for Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I do need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. I'm going to ask the callers to stay on hold while we talk about what I thought was very, very interesting issue. It started earlier this week when one of my patients asked me about it, and I hadn't read the article yet, so I just said, well, you know, I remember talking about this on the air when they announced it a few months ago at a conference, but I don't have the details, so went and got the details. Oh my God. This Alzheimer's test for cerebral spinal fluid, it's just a where do I start? Well, first of all, there were two things in the newspaper this week. One of them, a very self-congratulatory piece by Gina Colata of the New York Times. Not self-congratulatory by Gina, but a group of scientists and executives from the National Institute of Health, the FDA, and of course, the drug industries, also universities and nonprofits, all got together in a collaborative effort to find biological markers that show the progression of Alzheimer's disease. And of course, this paper has just come out, which I'm about to tell you about. And they were all so very excited and happy about it and talking about this Alzheimer's disease neuroimaging initiative, which began about 10 years ago, and how all of these groups that are traditional hereditary enemies got together and cooperated, and what a wonderful thing it all is. It's just really nice and optimistic piece until you kind of lift up the cover and look underneath, and then you see the crawly things. The story that my patient was asking me about was a spinal fluid test is found to predict Alzheimer's. This also came out in the New York Times. This was in the August 9th edition, and it was talking about an article that was to be published in the Archives of Neurology the following day. So let's talk about the Archives of Neurology paper for just a moment. This was a long-term study looking for biomarkers for cerebrospinal fluid. The idea was we're going to do a spinal tap and we'll look for proteins that would be in the CSF. These would also be proteins you'd be finding floating around in the brain. And we knew what targets to look for. We knew to look for amyloid beta and tau protein. Amyloid beta is the stuff that shows up in the plaques in the brain. And we can see those plaques with a PET scan. And it's a marker for Alzheimer's disease. And when you do an autopsy on a brain of a person with Alzheimer's disease, you can see these with a microscope and they disrupt the connections and interfere with nerve functioning. The other thing that they look for in the CSF was something called tau protein, which is kind of a I'm dying, help me signal that comes off of neurons as they involute or undergo apoptosis. This is cell death marker. And what the researchers were looking for was they were looking to see if there was one or the other of these tests in the CSF could be used as a marker, if we could do a test with antibodies or something and find these proteins, would it predict Alzheimer's disease? So they had a group of patients, and there were over 300 patients in their 70s. 114 had normal memories, 200 had memory problems, and 102 had Alzheimer's disease. So they looked for tau protein and amyloid beta. Here are the results. Listen carefully, all right? Nearly every person with Alzheimer's had the characteristic spinal fluid protein levels. Actually, 90% of them did, which means that 10% of them didn't. So it's not a completely predictive test. Furthermore, of the people who had mild cognitive impairment who had these proteins present, over 5 years, 100% of them went on to develop Alzheimer's disease. Well, that's kind of useful. On the other hand, and here's the rub, folks, 36% of the normal people who did not have cognitive problems had the same markers in their bloodstream. Oops, can you say false positive? And they didn't develop memory cognitive deficits in the next 5 years. And of course, we don't know for sure whether they ever will. What we do know is that if you do their genetic testing, there were more people with the APOE4 allele in that group of normal people who express tau and beta amyloid in their CSF. And we know that those people are at an increased risk for Alzheimer's disease. So basically what we have here is we have a massive 10-year collaboration between taxpayers in the form of the NIH and universities and drug companies throwing money at the problem to try to discover biomarker for Alzheimer's disease. And the subtext here, folks, is drug development. Basic marketing 101. First, you create a need, then you fill it. Well, Alzheimer's is a long latency disease, and we don't have a good way of predict who will get it. And by the time you have it, nothing has worked to really reverse it. So now the drug companies and the scientists are targeting, let's find it early and keep it from developing. Well, we need an early marker. So what we have now is we have a marker that is quite unreliable, that is about to be promoted heavily to the public and to the government as having predictive value for who will get Alzheimer's disease. And now we're going to have a lot of drugs being produced to affect this marker. So what we'll do is we'll do a spinal tap on you and we'll find that you have the marker. We'll give you the drug, and after 6 months, we'll show that the markers have reduced. In 10 or 20 years, we'll find out whether or not that actually makes a difference in whether you develop Alzheimer's disease. But in the meantime, in those 10 or 20 years, the drug companies will have pocketed a whole lot of money, and we're talking a whole lot of money, and it will have become, in our litigious society, malpractice not to do a spinal tap to find out if people have this protein so that we can give them this expensive drug. I have no doubt it will be expensive, and I also have no doubt that there will be unintended side effects and consequences of its use in order to maybe prevent Alzheimer's disease. But of course, we won't know that for a while. And you can bet we're going to err on the side of treatment. A related story came out. It was kind of funny, but someone in the American Journal of Cardiology actually put forth the idea that maybe we should put statins next to the ketchup and the mustard at McDonald's so that you could take a low dose statin. Those are over-the-counter in England, by the way, and this was an English group that wrote the paper. Their idea was, oh, you know, you have the hamburger, but you take the Lipitor or the generic Lipitor with the hamburger, and that's going to reduce the cholesterol, and therefore maybe it's a wash and the hamburger doesn't hurt you. This is nuts, of course, and hilarious, but it is not so far-fetched when you think about statins and cholesterol. It took a long time to establish that statins actually prevented heart disease, and everyone got very excited when it did. Actually, it takes a lot of statin in a lot of people to prevent one heart attack, but it's become sort of malpractice not to give people statins if their numbers fall into a certain criteria. Earlier this week, I had a cardiologist locally tell a woman who had an HDL of 90 and a LDL of 133 that she needed a statin because she's borderline diabetic with, I might add, very good diabetic control and no inflammation in her bloodstream. Now, there isn't any scientific basis for that advice, but there isn't a lot of scientific basis to avoid giving that advice either. And if you don't give that advice as a cardiologist and that patient has a heart attack, you can expect a lawsuit. So now we're going to have it for Alzheimer's. I am so excited. I am so happy that large chunks of the population are going to be put on unproven drugs to maybe fix the biomarkers for a disease that they may never develop. But that looks like where we're headed with this, and I'm putting it in quote marks, breakthrough. So let's talk to Robert in SoCal. Hello, Robert. Hi.
I'm a bit reluctant to bring up this issue, this conundrum, but let's give it a go. Back pain, bed mattress.
Yes.
I think bed mattresses are becoming, the manufacture and marketing of them are becoming scandalous. Because there are plenty of your listeners who are sleeping on beat up, old-fashioned mattresses and having a pretty good night's sleep. And I know there's a whole bunch of people who are buying the fancy $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 mattress beds, primarily foam.
Right.
And are now, I'm not the only one suffering from chronic back pain.
Well, okay. First of all, if you have back pain to start with, mm-hmm. I will tell you anecdotally, and I've never actually seen anybody do a study on this, but I will tell you anecdotally that I have had in my career a great many people who had kind of low-grade back pain in the mornings.
Right.
And it got better during the day, and they really didn't have back pain when they sat. And when I examined them, they had normal flexibility and no muscle spasm or anything. So I said, you know, get a new mattress and tell me, how old is your mattress? And if they said, well, I got it when I moved here 20 years ago, I said, well, you know, maybe you should get a new mattress. Nothing fancy, you know, whatever, pedic, foam or rubber thingy. Nothing super fancy. I just said, you know, go get a new mattress and see if it makes a difference. Or, you know, go to a motel and see if you wake up with the same pain. You know, spend $100 and go stay in a nice place. And in the morning, if your back pain's better, then you've established that you need a new mattress, at least something decent. And personally speaking, I was waking up with back pain for a couple of weeks after I tweaked myself throwing some pots in at Clay Creations, by the way. I'll give him a free plug. It's a nice little place down in Santa Cruz where you have a membership and they teach you how to throw pots, and that's been my summer project.
Yeah, but then you throw your back out.
I did throw my back out, as well as some very lumpy pots.
Good, good for you.
So as a result, my previously non-existent problem was aggravating in the morning, so I pestered my husband and we flipped the mattress over and backwards, and my back pain stopped. Totally anecdotal, but the next day I woke up and my back wasn't hurting, and it had been hurting for 10, 15 days before I thought to flip the mattress, which shows you how bright and clever I am about applying my medical knowledge to myself. But anyway, the bottom line is, it worked for me. I think changing your mattress is a decent idea. I don't think that the incremental value between, say, a $200 Costco version of whatever Costco happens to be selling this week in the way of mattresses versus one of the bed that advertises with Garrison Keillor, or the bed that you know, has the foam on it that's like from Sweden. I don't think there's any real basis to go there first, but I do think getting a new mattress, if you pass the motel test, is a worthwhile thing to do.
Well, let me just share some of my experiences.
Sure.
I purchased a Select Comfort, marketingly known as a Sleep Number.
Uh-huh.
And I really did not have any back pain, just mild. I mean, barely noticeable. And after the first night, the pain vanished. 5 years later, I'm having back pain. And it's because the foam has collapsed in the middle.
Yes.
And I also bought a Costco Posturepedic Sealy. They're, you know, they sell them by the hundreds every hour. And those beds are poorly made. They're very lightweight, and they're poorly made. Now, the bed that you have that you flipped over, those mattresses are no longer made. You don't flip mattresses. You don't flip contemporary modern mattresses.
How come? Anymore.
Because the way they're made with the foam, it's one side only.
Do they all have foam now? I mean, I'm mattress naive, so educate me.
For the most part, they're all foam with a minimal amount of steel. If you get a steel spring, it's minimal foam. All you have to do is go to Costco or any of these mattress discounters, and just lift up the bed. You can almost do it with two fingers. Okay, the mattress, not the box spring, of course.
Well, this sounds like a little bit like planned obsolescence.
Dr. Don, you said it, actually understated it correctly, but understated. I really believe it is a undisclosed scandal, and it's going to become a major problem. My mom won it in a drawing thing at a store opening, and it's a Simmons, and it's one of the flippable, okay? And the thing has got to be 30 years old or 25 years old, and it still works. I don't sleep on it. Somebody else does. My mattresses are the thousands of dollars mattresses.
And they're not as good. What you're saying is they're not as good.
And the $500 and $600 mattresses at Mattress Discounter, Costco, they're all made the same way.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
By the same people, and they are not going to work.
Robert, this is very interesting, and I hear your call to arms, and thank you for the information. Do you have any suggestions for how people might find an old mattress, or is there any way to find a manufacturer that still makes them and let's go viral on their website and order a lot of mattresses?
I've not done that, but I can guarantee you that the Tempur-Pedic, which is
right, okay,
fucking $4,000 or $5,000, top-of-the-line select comfort.
Right. Okay. Well, a lot of that money is going into advertising.
Right.
So.
Of course. And then supposedly.
All right. Robert, thanks for your perspective. And if anybody out there, are you a regular listener, Robert?
Yes, but I do have one final question.
Sure.
You asked me a question, and I'm unable to provide any information except a caveat. But the question I have is, where shall I go to get some information on the backache?
Okay. So here you go. You have a positional pain that is worse. I'm assuming that you fit the description. It's not worse when you sit. It's not worse lifting or moving.
If I sleep on my stomach, my back is broken.
Okay. So what we need to do is we need to evaluate your sacroiliac joint.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to look at the L5 S1 facet joint, because you're experiencing increased pain with extension of the spine. And those are the two structures that are vulnerable to that position overnight.
Okay.
And it may be that you've got loose ligaments. It may be that one leg is longer than the other and that you tolerate that when you're upright, but that sets you up for problems with extension at night. So obviously, no brainer. You have to sleep on your back with your legs bent and a bolster under your knees. And that will probably help short term. And certainly worth testing. But you need to see a doctor, and there's certain provocative examination things we do to try and sort out where the pain's coming from.
When you say doctor, what specialty?
Well, actually, I think what you need to do is see a good back doctor, and that's not necessarily one specialty or another. I don't like to give out specific doctors' names on the air,
okay,
obvious reasons. But if you email me, askdrdon.com, and remind me of our conversation, I will give you some names of people that I would refer my patients to if they came to me with this issue.
Drdon.com.
AskDrDon.com.
Ask. I'm sorry. Thank you, Dr. Don.
Thank you. Bye-bye. We had an off-air caller who wanted to put in a pitch for futons, and I will throw that out there. I will also anecdotally say that I can't stand futons, but that's me. And we have a follow-up call, Simon in Soquel. Simon, you had a mattress suggestion?
McCroskey's. The McCroskey Mattress Company in San Francisco. It's been there since about the earthquake. And they're great.
Okay,
they put
good.
A lot of great bed products. And they do have flippable mattresses.
Oh, good.
Which is unique. Now,
okay. All right. And how do you spell that?
McCroskey.
All right. Well, we have an answer for our previous caller. And I bet
they're
you there's some good old-fashioned curmudgeons.
they're very hip. They support the Silent Film Festival up there. And handout fans.
Cool. Oh, we had a correction. The mattress company in San Francisco that the earlier caller was extolling is McCroskey, McRoskey. Let's go to Rose in Santa Cruz. Hello, Rose, and welcome to the program.
Thank you for the show. I'm a longtime listener. I have been taking some citalopram, which is generic for Celestia.
Celexa.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I started, after taking it for several months, I started to get some arrhythmias and, did a little bit of research and found out, yes, there are arrhythmias associated with citalopram. So I've decided to reduce the dose and spoke to the doctor and I'm reducing it. But I seem to be getting very bad arrhythmias first thing in the morning. Do you have any suggestions?
How old are you?
63.
Okay. And you said you've been reducing the dose of Celexa. How long have you been on it?
5 months.
Okay.
And reducing it very slowly.
You don't need to reduce it very slowly. I don't know your situation. I don't know pre-existing heart disease. But in general, going off Celexa after you've been taking it for citalopram, after you've been taking it for 5 months, is not going to cause any discontinuation syndrome or any side effects. And anytime somebody over 50 gets an erratic heartbeat from a drug, I'm like, is this a life-saving drug that they will die without? Yes, no. No, stop the drug.
Exactly.
And so I don't think that cautious tapering is necessary, and I don't think that I would wait. First of all, you don't sound so suicidally depressed that you had the gumption to call the program, for example, which generally suicidal depressed people are logs and they can't do anything. So you'll be better off the medicine and seeing if your heart rhythm normalizes. You may be someone who doesn't metabolize the drug well, or who has issues around the balance of the neurotransmitters, et cetera, or it may be a complete coincidence, because depression can affect the heart adversely and is associated with sudden death arrhythmias. So maybe it's the depression that's triggering both the Celexa use and the arrhythmia. But either way, we need to eliminate a variable, and the drug's easy to eliminate.
Well, the pharmacist and the doctor have told me to do it very slowly.
Well, I disagree with them completely.
Okay.
You haven't been
I appreciate your input.
Yeah. You haven't been on it long enough to worry. They're just protecting their butts, but I won't protect mine. I'll just tell you, you know, if you were my patient, I would say stop it, because you're not going to have discontinuation syndrome after 5 months on this drug. That's a long-term side effect that comes after years. It's not a short-term side effect. And if you do, the discontinuation syndrome is better. It's going to make you feel unhappy, but it's better than having cardiac arrhythmias that potentially could throw you into a lethal rhythm.
Well, okay. I appreciate that. So about how long does it take for it to leave my body completely?
Well, that is a very good question, and it depends on your individual drug metabolism. Some people do not break this drug down quickly, and it depends upon their cytochromes in their liver and in their other body tissues.
Mm-hmm.
There's testing for that by a lot of those outfits that the FDA is currently coming down on, because they're doing genetic testing, I don't know, without having offered suitable bribery to the FDA or whatever. But Genova Diagnostics has a test that will test you for the enzymes that break down Celexa. It might be worth getting that done. I think the 23andMe test, which is a local Mountain View company, has that enzyme tested, and you could probably figure it out from the website. What you do is you go to look up cytochrome P450, and there are lots of tables. I'll send you a link.
P450?
Yeah, P450. If you just put that in a browser,
okay,
you'll find a table that tells you what drugs are metabolized by which of the subsystems of that. You look up citalopram, and then that's the enzyme system that you want tested. And then you go to these outfits and you figure out if they're testing for that enzyme. And I know they are, but I just don't remember off the top of my head which enzyme Celexa is. And,
great.
Yeah, and, you know, conservatively, I would say 3 to 4 weeks.
Okay.
So after a month, if the arrhythmias are still going on, the Celexa was an innocent bystander, and you've got to chase the arrhythmias.
Is it possible that that the Celexa could have started this?
Yes, possible, but I think it's not going to keep going without the Celexa if the Celexa was what started it.
Okay, unless it did damage.
No, why would it do damage? There's no basis for that.
Okay, I just know that various drugs sometimes do various kinds of things.
Right, but in this case, it's not going to cause structural or electrophysiological damage to the cells of the heart that would persist after the removal of the agent.
Very good.
That's okay.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a
Bye-bye.
Great day. Bye-bye.
You too.
Simon in Soquel.
The vaccination for shingles.
Yes.
I had. I already had it, actually. But then I looked it up, and it's it works about 50% of the time.
That's right. In studies, people who took the shingles vaccine to prevent shingles and then were followed over time had a 50% reduction in cases of shingles. So compared to having gotten a shot with an inert ingredient, a real test, in other words, where everybody thinks that they've got the shot, but only half of them really did.
Yeah.
Now, when I do the shot, I always tell people it's 50% effective. There is some evidence that it reduces the severity of the shingles for the people who do get it anyway, that it's not as bad as it would otherwise be. But that's hard to prove, because how do you score shingles severity? Do you score by body area? Do you score by a pain score? And pain scores, by the way, are really unreliable, and people have different pain thresholds, and it's hard to do science on pain. And you, if you do science on just the picture of how much of the body's affected, does that really correlate with the thing we're trying to prevent, which is the long-term neuropathic pain? And we don't know any answers to any of those things.
Yeah. Now, it also mentioned that it usually comes back in later life is when it hits.
Shingles, definitely.
Yeah.
Because as you get older, your immune system gets weaker. And the shingles virus never goes away. It's in there.
Lurking.
Lurking, yes. and it's waiting for its chance, like one of those spies, you know, in the Cold War that hangs around for 20 years and then gets activated.
Well, yeah, what is this? This mole.
Mole, yeah, exactly. Like a Jean Le Carré novel, except it's a virus.
Indeed. Yeah. Well, anyway, thank you, and like that.
Okay, well, bye. Thank you. Bye-bye. So let's talk to Suzanne in Van Lomond. Hello, Suzanne.
Hello, how are you?
Just fine, how are you?
I'm fine. I've got a question for you that may not be a medical problem, but it's mighty annoying.
Okay.
Itchy nipple. And I've gone online, apparently it's not all that uncommon, but nobody knows what to do about it. If it's not that uncommon, maybe you know something about it.
Well, yes, I do, a little bit. First of all, there are a couple of causes. There's one that's bad, which is called Paget's disease, and it's actually a kind of breast nipple cancer.
Mm.
So it has a particular appearance. The nipple gets sort of thickened and kind of looks like you've got psoriasis of the nipple.
Actually, the appearance is totally normal.
All right, good. So
Absolutely normal.
We can dismiss the bad thing.
Thank you.
And, you know, we always do that in medicine, and it's very annoying to patients, but we go to the bad thing first because our mentality is, what will kill the person? Do I need to do anything to make sure they don't have that? Yeah, that's a good attitude, but we tend to freak ourselves and everybody else out with it. But I guess, you know, you can't make an omelet and so on. Back to your problem. A lot of people are sensitive to fabric softeners. So the next thing I tell people to do is get rid of your dryer sheets and your fabric softener in your brassiere or
t-shirts. I use no fabric softeners. I haven't changed laundry soap recently.
Good.
Or bath soap recently.
Good. Okay, so we've eliminated that one. If you're over 60,
mm-hmm.
then dry skin is often a culprit. And so I'll have people do a lot of moisturizing.
Oh.
And you can use, Vaseline works very well, actually.
Mm-hmm.
You can use the breast shields that the lactating women use and put those over the breast and put Vaseline and then put a bra on. And that really moisturizes. And for a lot of people, that will take care of the itching.
Hmm. Shea butter does wonders on the rest of my skin.
Yes, and you could use that, but I think I would go with the Vaseline just because it's like the strongest moisturizing agent, and it really prevents evaporative loss as well. So it's quite good to do that after your shower. Try that for a week and see what happens. Or do one, if you want to be really scientific, do one side.
Well, it's only one that's itchy.
Well, in that case, you'll have to try it for a week.
Okay. That's easy enough.
All right. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go to Tom in Santa Cruz. By the way, I think we struck a nerve with the mattress question. Hello, Tom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I couldn't help but call in about the mattress thing. I'm a local artist. I've met with you before, and I work part-time in a store that sells mattresses and futons, and we make our own mattresses there. And I wanted, rather than, you know, do an advertisement, I did want to say that oftentimes people hang on to mattresses way too long, and the foam compresses, and they get very uncomfortable, and not everyone is suited to a very firm mattress. Every body is really different, and it's kind of a process of experimenting and trying different things and finding what works for you.
Mm-hmm.
But there is definitely designed obsolescence in conventional mattresses. All the big nationally advertised name brands use lower density foam in making their mattresses. Coils tend to not wear out, but the foam compresses. And then you're feeling more pressure on the heaviest parts of your body.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
So futons are generally made of cotton, which compresses. They can become firm, slumpy, and lumpy. Not everyone is happy with a very firm mattress, but some people are. And love them.
Exactly. It's very individual, and I think you make an excellent point there. If you're a local company and you want to give the name of your local company, I will let you do that.
Oh, okay. Well, we're Bay Bed and Mattress, and we use higher quality foam and latex in our mattresses, which doesn't compress. We have a very unique feature. It's a zippered top, and we can switch out foam layers and adjust the firmness of a mattress.
Ah, sounds to me like you're about to put yourself out of business with a product that doesn't go obsolete and can be repaired quickly and easily.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, people are very happy with the beds, and during the first 30 days, they can call up and say, I want it firmer, I want it softer, and we'll come out and do that for them. But it's really true that most mattresses give out and develop those divots and body impressions, and it's primarily from lower density foam. Some things work great for individuals: Tempur-Pedic, dual adjustable air beds, water beds. People find something that works for them, that's great. But I'd recommend looking into investing in a quality mattress. And even if you can't afford that, like you said, if you've had a mattress for a long time, just getting a new one goes a long way to remedy a back problem.
I usually use morning back pain as the indicator of whether I make that suggestion.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Tom.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And we'll do a quick check-in with Marcia, who I believe is talking about the same company. Marcia, are you an employee or a customer?
I'm a customer. That's very funny that he was just on.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I agree with everything he said, but I want to just say that when people go out and buy new mattresses, it's a very expensive thing to keep buying new mattresses every time you buy one.
Indeed.
And unfortunately, I went through quite a number of mattresses, and for a long period of time was having a lot of difficulty. And I finally stumbled on Bay Bed and their zipper top. And indeed, he came out a number of times to put different foam and to try this and to try that. And eventually it worked. And I have been pain-free. And I know that I can just unzip it and put another piece of foam in if it compresses. It's not like throwing away a $800 mattress and starting all over. So to me, it was a godsend.
Great. Well, we have one satisfied customer and who has no self-interest, obviously. And thank you very much for calling in.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. So I hoped I would have time for this, and I do. So we're going to kind of talk about that DNA testing I alluded to a little while ago, a couple of times actually, once in reference to the Alzheimer's disease. And, you know, the DNA testing doesn't really have a lobby with the FDA, so they're getting a lot of pushback. Some of that's justifiable, and I want to present a balanced viewpoint here, because when we start testing for genetics, we have to be really careful that having DNA doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be expressed. So just the fact that you have DNA in your cells doesn't ever mean it's going to wake up and do something. So it's not a 100% prediction. The other thing about DNA testing is that we only know a certain amount, and a lot of this has to do with interactions with the environment and whether or not you're using a certain drug or a set of drugs, or whether you're exposed to organic pollutants, and also what your other DNA is. And there's a great amount of interaction. Things like how much sulfur in your diet, whether you get a lot of methyl groups or not, could have huge implications. And those are not things that we're testing for when we do DNA testing. So all of that being said, what we really need is large groups of data. And UC Berkeley was doing something very innovative. They were trying to teach about science. Every year they have a yearly exercise to have a common educational experience for all of the students, to get them talking about something, thinking big picture, cross-disciplinary. I mean, it's a great idea. And this year's theme was personalized medicine. So back in May, all of the new freshmen and transfer students got a testing kit asking them to volunteer to submit cheek swabs of their DNA. And it was called, you know, Bring Your Genes to Cal. And the idea was that they would get all this data, and they were going to give the students back some personal information. You know, this is like the Framingham study. You could go and find these people 20 years from now and find out what disease they got. And you might be able to pull more information out of knowing their genomes now. So it's a great idea. And they were going to use their own lab to do the work, because obviously they're doing genome work at Berkeley. So it was going to be relatively inexpensive for them, kind of a bootstrap thing. it's a really brilliant idea. The students would get something out of it. They were going to find out about their genes to break down lactose, metabolize alcohol, and absorb folate. And of course, the folate gene is very important because we've talked about homocysteine and the MTHFR mutation, and you can go back into the website and find out more about that. I'm not going to recap that now. But this is an important mutation that maybe 10% of the population has that affects the risk of heart disease and cancer, and they need to behave differently if they've got this mutation. We're not doing that right now in medicine. And that's what personalized medicine is, looking at the strengths and weaknesses of your DNA and figuring out how to play to your strengths and avoid your weaknesses. Well, they got in such trouble up at Berkeley for doing this. The California Department of Public Health, which has been coming down on the genetic testing companies, that one of which, 23andMe, I alluded to earlier in this program, got in their face, and the state regulators were raising questions like, who has the authority to tell an individual what they're allowed to know about themselves? What about this genetic information? Could it be misinterpreted or misused? Would students who learn that they metabolize alcohol well start drinking more? I mean, just come on, guys, get a grip. And this just got torpedoed. It became a political controversy, and they're just shutting the whole thing down. They're going to incinerate the samples. Everybody's freaked out about privacy. You know, they're getting, you know, Nazi allegations about doing a mass experiment. Okay, big time overreaction, but it does raise a lot of issues that we need to think about and discuss as a culture. And really what we need is a lot more scientific literacy, because if people have scientific literacy, then they understand what the test means and doesn't mean. They're able to get the idea of probability. They're able to get the idea it's not black and white, and there are variables, and here's what we know, and here's what we don't know. We just need to get a grip and teach our children about statistics. And if we were all a little bit more scientifically literate, including, I might add, the people at the state regulatory level, I think we could calm down and actually do something like this and get the information, because I thought this was a brilliant idea. And I don't think that any of the criticisms that are being leveled against it are, in fact, reasonable or justified. But hey, that's me. The GAO's main criticism was about interpreting the results and how predictive is a particular SNP. Yeah, of course, but so what? You need someone to help you interpret that. People could get that. That doesn't mean that you throw the baby out with the bathwater and just outlaw these tests or come down on the backs of a university that's seeking to do what universities are supposed to do, which is advance human knowledge. I meant to do this at the top of the show. I didn't, so I'll do it now. I will be appearing today from 11 to 2 o'clock at Bayview Elementary in a pediatric health fair. We're going to be checking children's BMIs and teaching them a little bit about good and bad nutrition and portion sizes. And if you come, you get a sticker. So Bayview Elementary is at the corner of Mission and Bay in Santa Cruz. Come by and say hi if you get a chance. And if you have a pediatric person in the household, all the more reason to show up. The public is invited. The article I wanted to talk to you about, just a little study. In 1997, 5% of Caucasian 7-year-old girls were starting to develop breast buds, and 15% of African-American girls had breast buds. In 2010, 10.4%, a doubling of Caucasian 7-year-old girls have breast buds. That's a lot earlier. And the number went from 15 to 23.4% in African-American girls. This is a big jump. It is probably somewhat, if not entirely, related to obesity, but it is not just being overweight, looking like the breasts are heavier. The people who did this assessment were educated and could tell the difference between just fat and breast gland tissue. So it's a real phenomenon. Is it due to pesticides? Is it due to some of the hormone mimics or quote-unquote endocrine disruptors, though I hate that term, in body care products that we've been reading about or in plastic water bottles? Maybe. It's a big fat question mark, but we're getting earlier puberty. That means that we're going to see, for those girls, an increased lifelong risk of breast cancer without much benefit. So we need to figure out what we've done and how to reverse it. And this should be a priority. Let's go to Leah in Santa Cruz. Hello, Leah. Welcome to the program.
Hi. It's a sort of double question. It begins with my waking up in the morning with my left hand feeling frozen. And then, of course, as I start to wake up and move it and you know, it comes back completely. But last week, I woke up one morning with my whole left arm hurting, and I've heard that that could be connected with the heart. So, you know, the numbness and frozen, and also my left leg gets numb. I was walking through the museum yesterday at San Francisco, and my left thigh, part of my left leg started feeling numb. So I'm beginning to wonder if I should have some kind of test
for
my heart.
Well, actually, you're thinking about your heart, and I'm not thinking about your heart.
Oh, good.
How old are you?
Oh, I'm over 60.
All right. So when you get numbness that you're waking up with, there's a list of things. Heart disease, when you're having a heart attack or angina, it can radiate to the left arm. It's generally pain, not numbness. And so if you start out with numbness and then it moves to pain, that's reassuring to me from the standpoint of heart. That doesn't mean you couldn't also have a heart condition, but the symptom is not characteristic, okay?
Good.
So starting with that, I got a little more worried. My alarm bell went off when you said that you're also getting numbness in your leg when you walk around.
Now, that was the first time, yesterday.
Common things are common, but when you have numbness one-sided on both upper and lower parts of the body, that makes me worry about something in the neck that's pushing on the central cord.
Oh, last month, a folding chair that I sat down on unfolded, and I fell flat and hard on my sacrum, and I haven't been the same since.
Okay. For the sake of argument, okay, we're going to play that game I talked to the other person about, which is the figure out the worst case scenario here, make sure the person doesn't have that, then figure it out.
Okay.
So what would we not want to miss that would be bad for you? And that would be, I'll tell you what it is and how to look for it, and then we'll continue the discussion.
Okay.
What would be bad that could tie all of these symptoms together, top of the list in my mind, is if a disc, when you pop down or else just on its own, if a disc in your neck popped and the goo that's inside the disc is pushing on the side of the spinal cord, and that would be causing the pain, and that would be causing the numbness in your leg and also causing maybe the numbness in the arm. Now, if that's the case, it'll show up in a neck
X-ray.
CT or MRI, not an X-ray.
Oh. Okay. So what was the first thing you said? A neck
CT or an MRI.
Or an MRI. So that's what I should ask for?
Yeah. Because of those symptoms, because they're left-sided, that's the picture that would be the bad thing we wouldn't want to miss. Now, you could have, you know, a separate problem down in the leg. Could be that you're old enough to have arthritis and you're getting some nerve that's being pinched or squeezed. And that's called spinal stenosis. It can happen from arthritis in the spinal column. It can happen from a tight muscle pushing on the nerve, although it got called spinal stenosis when that happens. So, you know, you fell down, you hit the butt muscles when you went down. So maybe those muscles are grabbing when you were walking and squeezing the sciatic nerve and causing that. And it's a completely separate issue, which is fine. It could be. If you're very heavy and you've got a belly or you're wearing a fanny pack.
I'm not heavy and I wasn't wearing a fanny pack.
But people who are doing that can put pressure on the nerve as it comes out under the inguinal ligament in the groin, and they'll get numbness on the front of the thigh. So I threw that one out because I don't want everybody who's sitting out there with numbness on the front of their thigh to figure that this is what they've got. Because, you know, it's the old don't Google your symptoms thing. Well, don't, you know, don't assume that you've got what Dr. Don is talking about that's terrible, because I don't want to give anybody that head trip. Okay, so back to the arm, which is where we started. If
that only happened once, that
the pain.
Arm was hurting when
But the numbness has been happening more.
A long time, the numbness.
Here's what I would say. If it's carpal tunnel, most typically it'll wake you up at night, but it doesn't have to. So if it's carpal tunnel, when you wake up with the numbness, touch your pinky finger and see if the pinky is also numb.
Okay.
Because if the pinky is numb, it's not carpal tunnel. And so that's a really useful little test. And you do it while you've got it, you'll know the answer. If the pinky is not numb and the thumb is numb, it's probably carpal tunnel, just on the basis of playing the odds. That's the most common reason that you would get this. So pushing on the nerve in the neck, pushing on the nerve where it comes up over a rib. Some people have muscle spasm in the neck that squeezes the nerves as they come down the arm. And sometimes a muscle spasm in the neck can actually cut off the blood supply. So if the pinky is also numb and you're over 60, you could be having poor blood flow to the arm at night because you're lying on it, because you're kinking your neck in a certain way, and the artery is stiff because you're over 60, so it's not flowing well into the arm. So that's another possibility that would be a relatively benign thing, but could explain your symptoms. I would start with going to my primary care doctor or my internist and making sure that they hear that you've got the left-sided symptoms in the leg and the left arm, and that pesky radio doctor said maybe we should look in the neck for a disc pushing on the spinal column, because that could do that, and I certainly don't want to have that. But they'll examine you, and when they examine you, there are lots of little tests that they can do that will say, oh no, this is carpal tunnel for sure, or yeah, it's a pinched nerve from the muscle that you came down hard on, and that's what gave you the leg numbness. So there's lots of little provocative tests we can do, and while the physical examination is becoming a lost art, we have so many great imaging studies that we're forgetting how to put our hands on people's bodies. Most doctors who are practicing actually do have a good grounding in physical exam at this point. They haven't all retired yet. So I would start there, but I think you have to get this looked at and pronto, okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Julius in Los Angeles. Hello, Julius. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dr. Don. Are the involuntary responses of the body caused by the subconscious mind or by the body?
Give me an example of what you mean by involuntary responses.
Like an erection?
Okay. So if they're caused by the body or the mind, that question presupposes that there is, in fact, a difference between the body and the mind. And while I think there might be a difference between the body and the soul, which I tend to believe in, just for whatever that's worth, I don't know that the mind can be separated from the body, because the mind is essentially an emergent phenomenon coming out of the brain, which is a very biological structure and has things like hormones and responds to blood sugar and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So let's use erections as an example. We know that you can get a spinal erection by a reflex. So erections can come just from physical touch. Like, for example, someone who has a spinal column injury, so their nerves are cut and they have nothing getting from below the cut to their brain. So their brain is not participating in this, but they still have a healthy arc. And so you can get an erection in that circumstances just from physical stimulation of the penis, and they'll get an erection even though the brain can't feel anything. So we know that can occur. That would be a reflex, like you're saying, caused just by the body, if you want to say that the reflex arc that goes to the spinal column is part of the body and not part of the brain. And that's a matter of semantics more than anything else. You can also not touch a person, have them hanging in a sensory deprivation chamber and have them think about their beloved or think about something sexy, and they'll get an erection. So that person isn't being touched at all, and it's purely being stimulated by the mind. Another example might be something.
Do you think it can become a voluntary response, like just like moving your hand?
To will yourself to get an erection? Yeah, I bet you that if you practiced it, that could become, at least in people who had the requisite physiology, in other words, good blood flow, adequate nitric oxide, no neuropathy, everything's working well from the
I was shocked spiring. To learn on Wikipedia how complicated a process of an erection is.
Really?
And,
you thought it was simple, huh?
I thought it was much more simple than it is. When I was young, I used to be able to maintain an erection after orgasm. Have you ever heard of that before? Anybody else?
Oh, yeah. I mean, hands are going up all over the radio land on that one.
I thought I was the only one. I never heard anybody else talk about that.
Well, I guess you probably are a typical guy and, you know, don't discuss things that after you get the girl and what happens later. But yes, it is, in fact, I shouldn't assume get the girl. Now, look at me. I'm making an assumption there. But anyway, after orgasm, turgor can continue. That's a given. By the way, that effect tends to have a use-by date and disappears as people enter into middle age. And that has to do with the health of the blood flow and the testosterone levels as well. Any other questions?
Doctor,
I don't know. I think you're gaming me a little bit here, and so
no, you want to hear this, Doctor? Don't.
All right. I just want you to know I got my hand on the thing here because you're losing credibility
by the second.
I'm
not playing with you. I'm
okay.
not gaming.
Go
no,
for
I'm
it.
Not.
Tell me then.
I asked my psychologist what the mind is, And he just stared at me for like, you know, he had no answer. He just stared at me. Isn't that incredible?
Well, I guess you would have expected someone who has a graduate degree in the mind to have a better answer than that. Let me put it this way. Was he paying attention to what you said before you said that?
Yeah. I said, what's going on? And he said, well, I don't have a quick and dirty answer for you.
Shame on him. I already told you what the mind is. The mind is an emergent phenomenon that comes out of the physical structure of the brain. And
you really believe the brain can explain the mind?
No, I believe that all emergent phenomena are unexplainable at our current level of understanding.
What does that mean, emergent? I forgot.
Emergent means that you have a setup, like a complicated system, that you can dissect it to all you want, and you still can't predict where it's going to go. Like, for example, weather prediction can only go so far, because there are all of these variables that can't be analyzed, and there are these dynamic things that effectively make it something we can model mathematically, but we can never predict. So we can model it, and we can do statistics on our model, and then we can apply those statistics to the system, and we can make a loose kind of prediction in the larger sense. I can make a loose prediction that the human mind will get sleepy and that the person will require sleep every 24 or 36 hours, or there'll be a deterioration of their functioning. And that'll be generally true, but I can't tell you that your functioning is going to decline at 18 hours versus 28 hours. The same thing is true of how you would react to a stimulus. There are so many variables in terms of what your brain's doing, what your memory is, what your genetics are doing, that I can only say in general that if you are in a building and you smell smoke, and somebody yells fire, that you will probably experience an increase in your heart rate because you will become excited and feel threatened. You see, that's as good as we get in our understanding of the mind, and that's pitiful compared to, say, the works of Shakespeare or the upper regions of philosophy. We can't understand the mind because we don't have any place to step outside of the mind in order to look at the mind.
Beautiful. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.